first the importance of the Middle East in the First World War, and I'm going to argue that this war, above all else, was an imperial war. That's a war for the protection of empire and the extension of empire, and these two are not actually opposites. Because Britain in particular, in order to protect the existing empire, the leaders thought it was necessary to extend it. And the campaigns, the various campaigns in the Middle East, were very important in this regard, since that's where there was territory which was likely to become available. And it actually did come available and was acquired by the victorious powers at the end of the war. We're talking about Britain and France. During the course of the next 30 minutes, I'd like to bear two things in mind. Firstly, there was a television programme hosted by Max Hastings, and it was entitled The Necessary War. I think this was back in February. Now, Max Hastings, he not only said that Britain entered the war over Germany's violation of Belgian neutrality, but he went further than that, and he generalised, and he said, with that sincere look on his face that only he can do, he said, Britain cared deeply about the rights of small nations. He did actually say that. Now, there's an obvious objection to that, which is that Britain, by the end of the war, had an empire covering 25% of the land area of the globe and including 20% of the world's population. And you don't get that by giving a damn about the rights of small nations. But setting that aside, let's look at how this plays out in the war in the First World War in the Middle East. The second thing I'd like to quote from this is the 2014 edition, Life in the UK Test Handbook, Everything You Need to Study for the British Citizenship Test. Now, don't ask me why I've got that, but it mentions, as you might expect, British values. And these, of course, include fair play and fairness. Now, if these were listed simply as an aspiration, I wouldn't be referring to it. But let me tell you what it says in here. It says, these are based on history and tradition. So that's the second thing I want you to bear in mind. And let's see how that plays out in the First World War in the Middle East. I'll briefly give you an overview of the war. There were five major campaigns, two minor campaigns, augmented by a whole range of agreements, promises, counter-promises, and various declarations. Of the five major campaigns, three were primarily British, one was British and Arab, and the other, which I just want to put out of the way for now, because I'm not going to dwell on it, was the Ottoman-Russian front. This is south of the Caucasus, in what would now be northeastern Turkey. And the significance of that is that the Armenians who lived in that area were in peril, since being Orthodox Christians, like the Russians, were regarded by the Turks as a kind of fifth column. And many were killed in situ, and thousands, hundreds of thousands, in fact, were moved south and died through malnutrition, maltreatment, and so on. The campaigns involving the British were these. This is in the order in which they occurred. First, the Mesopotamia campaign, which lasted from the first day of the war in the Middle East, which was the 1st of November, 100 years ago, quite appropriately, relied mainly on Indian troops who suffered greatly during episodes such as the Siege of Kut. Now, John Haywood has put a small exhibition about the Siege of Kut. Please look at it when you get time. In relation to his father's experience there during the war. Thousands died of disease and starvation. Secondly, the Gallipoli campaign, which I think is one that everybody knows about, an utter failure, lasted roughly through 1915. It has no direct legacy as such, but it's important to note, because of its failure, the British had to find other means to make inroads into the Ottoman Empire, and that's why we have these other campaigns. Thirdly, the Arab Revolt, associated with the figure of T. Lawrence and the myths surrounding him. I'll be dealing with him quite severely later on. I'm going to concentrate today on the political rather than the military side of the war. So if anybody was expecting sand flies, blood and guts, then you're in the wrong room. Sorry about that. And I'm going to concentrate on the British in the Middle East, not simply because we're here in Britain, because the French were practically not there till after the war. The Russians withdrew after the revolution of 1917, and the Germans were only there in very small numbers, attached to Ottoman fighting units, often in a commanding position. Why did Turkey enter the war on the side of the Central Powers? I mean, there's more to this than I can deliver today, but it wasn't a foregone conclusion. I think it's important to say that. The Ottoman leaders, there was a triumvirate of the people known as the Young Turks, who were divided over which side to join. However, an important factor in this is that Churchill, as first Sea Lord, in August 1914, commandeered two naval vessels then being built for the Turks. One was on the Tyne somewhere, the other was at Barrow-in-Furness. And this certainly nudged the Ottomans towards supporting Germany. One of these ships, by the way, had been purchased through public subscription. There are stories of women selling the jewellery to fund it and so on. So you can imagine the public outrage in Turkey. Now, this was in no way regarded as a blunder by Churchill, because Churchill especially and others was quite happy about the prospect of war with Turkey. He certainly underestimated them militarily, hence the disaster of Gallipoli. But more importantly, he saw an advantage in Britain acquiring territory in that vital area between the Mediterranean and the Arabian Gulf, of course on the flanks of the Suez Canal, in order to protect the route to India. So they weren't troubled about that at all. Three factors that I need to deal with very briefly before we get into other aspects of the war. The question of oil, which often comes up. Now, I think objectively, one can say that oil was of paramount importance in 1914. The decision to convert the Royal Navy to oil had been taken stages between 1911 and 1913. However, the programme was aborted, but it was only aborted because Britain did not have a secure supply of oil. And once the war started, it may surprise you, but oil was little mentioned until the end of the war. It was only in the closing stages of the war, and there's this well-known quote from the Secretary of the Imperial War Cabinet, Sir Maurice Hankey, and he says, "Control of these," meaning Mesopotamian oil supplies, becomes a first-class war aim. A war aim, incidentally, is what you do at the end of the war, not at the beginning of the war. I think some people get that wrong, but that's how it works. Such was the hunger for oil by October 1918 that British forces continued to advance north in breach of the armistice with the Turks on the 31st of October 1918, and they carried on advancing for between 3 to 15 days. There's a bit of uncertainty there, depending on which source you go to. That's the fine example of British fairness that I'll mention today. There will be others, but agree an armistice and carry on fighting. That's exactly what they did. Two other important factors. First, to do with Islam, and I'm talking specifically about British imperial Islamophobia. With the possession of India, with its nearly 70 million Muslims at that time, Egypt on the flanks of the Suez Canal, a primarily Muslim country, once at war with Turkey, there was a fear that the Ottoman Sultan, as the Caliph of Islam, as the leader of Muslims, nominally at least, there was a fear that he would declare a worldwide jihad against Turkey's Christian enemies. Now, in actual fact, he did this. It didn't have great consequences, except for one incident. There was a mutiny of 850 Indian sepoys in February 15, then stationed in Singapore. 47 British personnel were killed and 47 Indians publicly executed by firing squad in response. It was this overriding fear of the capacity of Islam to unite people across national boundaries that led the British to support the idea of an Arab as opposed to an Ottoman caliphate in Arabia, i.e. in Mecca. I'll return to that when we deal with the Arab revolt. Thirdly, the French factor. Now, imperial powers are, by their nature, paranoid creatures. The other phobia of the British, which I think surprises some people from reading the correspondence of British agents and imperialists in the Middle East at this time. You would have thought that the real enemy was France and not Germany. It's really, I promise you. And this is because you're an European imperialist on this particular issue would have been in agreement with Lenin. They believed that in the era of modern imperialism, the whole world would not only be divided amongst the imperial powers, but continually re-divided between them. And it followed that in the minds of imperialists, all imperial alliances were provisional and expedient. In other words, these people genuinely thought that if they won the war against Germany, the next enemy could just as easily be France. And that's how they proceeded in the Middle East. They didn't want the French to obtain too much territory. I'll turn to the Mesopotamian campaign very briefly. The initial objective of this campaign, it was a British Indian occupation of southwest Persia. This was where there was the only British-owned oil field there. We need to put this in the context that on the outset, this was in November 14. In August 1914, Persia had declared her neutrality in this war. To compound matters, in March 1915, Britain entered into a secret agreement with Imperial Russia to partition Persia after the war. So that's a message really there for Max Hastings, so much for the rights of small nations. As I said, in Mesopotamia, Britain relied mainly on Indian troops, and by way of an inducement to suffer for the empire, the British intimated that they would permit moves towards democracy after the war. In fact, these were not honoured at all. Not a war for democracy either. It was this betrayal which induced Gandhi and a number of others to embark on a career of activism against the British. The three main agreements during the war, I'll just list these. There's one called the Hussein McMahon correspondent involving the Arabs, which I'll explain why I'm doing that later. Second one with the French, British French, and the third one with the Zionists, and it's interesting to see how these relate to one another. First, the agreement with the Arabs. This is the first. It's not really with the Arabs, it's actually with a certain group of Arabs. Most Arabs probably knew nothing about it. Known as the Hussein McMahon correspondence. It's a series of correspondence between the then High Commissioner of Egypt and Hussein Sharif of Mecca, and this goes on between July 15 and January 16. The Sharif was a quasi-religious figure, an appointee of the Ottoman Sultan with responsibilities for the holy places of Islam and for hosting the annual Hajj. In December 14, the British in Cairo issued a declaration to the Arabs, and it included the following. It said, Great Britain knows as well as the Muslims that the Islamic Caliphate is a right of the Quraysh, the tribe of the great prophet of Islam. And incidentally, the Sharif is also descended from this tribe. The government of Great Britain, therefore, promises you help if you help yourselves and take steps to establish an empire for the Caliphate to administer your vast territories. So they're basically promising sort of freedom to the Arabs on the basis of an Arab caliphate. And the phrase that they use at the time is that they sought to rule Arabia from behind the veil of Islam. That's how they used to put it. So the British were going to stand behind the caliphate and somehow secretly rule Arabia from behind it. That seriously is what they intended to do. The correspondence ostensibly recognised, they referred to the independence of the Arabs, and there were certain exceptions. One was the provinces of Basra and Baghdad, which are about the southern two-thirds of present-day Iraq. And they refer very vaguely, very ineptly, to part of the Syrian coast, which involved certain French interests. Now, regardless of the merits or demerits of this agreement, it was sufficient to secure an alliance with the Sharif and those who supported him. And this is the political basis, or diplomatic basis, for the Arab revolt, made famous later by T. Lawrence. Secondly, the agreement with the French. This slightly overlaps with Hussein McMahon. They began to negotiate with the French over the disposition of the Middle East after the war. It not only included the areas of more or less direct annexation, which are referred to in his assignment mine, but it extended these, and it split that whole northern part of the Arab world into zones of influence. And they did this while negotiating with Sharif Hussein, but without consulting him. So it was a bit of a sort of double cross there. Most notably, the agreement left Palestine as an international zone. And the reason for this is that the British and the French could not agree on the disposition of Palestine, and rather than fall out about it at the time, they said, well, just leave it as an international zone and deal with it later. But consequently, because of that, no sooner than the ink was dry than the British began to look for ways to undermine the agreement, and this is in the area of Palestine. A bit about Lawrence and the Arab revolt. The revolt began on the 5th-6th June 1916 in Mecca, the main thrust going north. I'm just going to concentrate to deal with a few things to do with the myths surrounding Lawrence of Arabia. Generally regarded as a friend of the Arabs and as an advocate of Arab independence, he was first and foremost a British imperialist. He supported Zionism. He thought that it would be a good idea for the Arabs. He thought it would aid them economically. Regarding the national rights of the Arabs, he's recorded as saying the following. He says, self-determination has been a good deal talked about. I think it is a foolish idea in many ways. We might allow the people who have fought with us to determine themselves. He says, but people like the Mesopotamian Arabs who have fought against us deserve nothing from us in the way of self-determination. In other words, it wasn't considered to be a right, the right of the Arabs to have self-determination, but it was something you earned by serving the British Empire. In Seven Pillars of Wisdom, that book many of you will be familiar with, he said that I could see that if we won the war, the promises to the Arabs were dead paper. Had I been an honourable advisor, it's a bit of an admission there, I would have sent my men home. He's talking about the Arabs who fought with him, and not let them risk their lives for such stuff. Yet the Arab inspiration was our main tool in winning the Eastern War. I think he's right about that. I won't extend on that at the moment. And he hoped that in supporting the Arab revolt, he would have, and these are his words, abolished the threat of Islam by dividing it against itself. In other words, he was supporting the idea of Islamic conflict between the Arabs and the Turks. The agreement with the Zionists. Now, you may have thought that the idea of a British-backed caliphate is grandiose enough. I would say that the idea of Britain supporting a restored Jewish state in Palestine, where at that time over 90% of the population were Arabs in 1914, I think it's even more grandiose. And the reason that I say that, we should remember from where we are today that after 132 years of colonisation, the ethnic cleansing of over 90% of the Arab population from the area occupied by the State of Israel by 1948-49, the endless oppression and killing of Palestinians, and all of this with the backing of the predominant imperial states of the day, previously Britain, later the United States, that Jews at this time do no longer constitute a majority of the population within historic Palestine. And at the same time, the majority of the world's Jews do not live in Palestine. In other words, in its own terms, and I repeat that, in its own terms, Zionism is as yet an utter failure. So I do consider this a truly grandiose idea. There's a traditional way of dealing with the Balfour Declaration, I think, which abstracts it from its context. It concentrates very much on the skill, charm and shrewdness of the Zionists then lobbying the British government. And according to extreme forms of this version, these people managed to persuade members of the British government to back the Zionist project against their better judgment and against British interests. And this view I regarding as corresponding to certain anti-Semitic stereotypes, which present Jews as persuasive middlemen, traders in dodgy merchandise, the kind of people who knock on your door and try and sell you fake jewellery and that kind of thing. Corresponding to this idea and this we're still here today, was that the British establishment was divided between Arabophiles and Judeophiles. These two attitudes, I would maintain, are analogous. And whereas people like T. Lawrence was undoubtedly romantically attached to the Bedouin, he in fact despised the modern urbane, besuited Arab that you might find in Beirut or Damascus. He regarded them as inauthentic. Likewise, British supporters of Zionism, though they idealised the Jew of the Old Testament, despised his modern counterpart. And if you're doubtful about that, I could quote you some things later on. To return to Britain's real reasons for supporting Zionism at this stage, I think Asquith, who was the Prime Minister at the beginning of the war, he gets it about right when he says of Lord George, this is March 1915, he says he doesn't care a damn for the Jews, or their past or their future, but thinks that it would be an outrage to let the Christian holy places pass into the possession or under the protectorate of agnostic, atheistic France. It's nothing to do with the atheism and agnosticism of France, but certainly these people did not want Palestine to go to the French. Now, the way this works is as follows. There were other reasons for Britain supporting Zionism, but that's the most immediate reason, that's what I'm saying. In order to undermine the Sykes-Picot Agreement and to ensure that Palestine became British, Sykes, who had negotiated the previous agreement with the French, he adopted a very, what we call it, an instrumental attitude towards Zionism. And he thought that a British undertaking to support Zionism would in turn induce the Zionists to prefer a British protectorate over a French one, or an international one indeed. And in order to make this more persuasive, there were two other things that were necessary. And I hope you'll understand how this works. First, it was important to let Zionists stand for the Jews, was the first thing. And secondly, to encourage the idea that world Jewry were all powerful, that they could, for example, keep Russia in the war, get the United States into the war, and finance the Allied war effort. And this is exactly what Sykes did. At each stage in the proceedings, when he went back to the French to renegotiate, he took with him Chaim Weizmann and Nachum Sokolov, the two leading Zionists at the time. It was on his instructions that they prepared various memoranda and the first draft of the Balfour Declaration. And in proceeding along this path, the British government was forced to marginalise the equally vociferous, equally powerful Jewish lobby who were implacably opposed to Zionism. And this is absolutely true. There were the same number. It's still that Jewish patch, a load of rubbish. It really is. There were equally powerful people going to the government saying, we don't like Zionism. It's a damn nuisance. It'll cause anti-Semitism. And they just sidelined them. So they chose the lobby that they were listening to. And I think this has counterparts today. The long-term consequences, the legacy of this war with relevance to today. Just a brief note on the caliphate. Caliph in Arabic means successor, as in successor to the Prophet. Since the death of the Prophet in 632 AD, there have been several dynasties of caliphs, and the last of these were the Ottoman Sultans from around 1517. The caliphate, the institution of the caliphate, was abolished in March 24 by Ataturk. His immediate reasons for doing so were, firstly, he wanted to establish a secular Turkish national state in what remained of the Ottoman Empire so he could dispense with the caliphate. And secondly, he wished to eschew all extraneous responsibilities attached to the office of the caliphate, which I think at the time must have seemed onerous to him. What I'm referring to there is something called the caliphate movement in India, where literally millions of Indian Muslims lobby for the retention of the caliphate. And in fact, at one point, they ask Ataturk to take it up, and he doesn't want that. However, many Muslims have argued, and many do now, that with some justification, I think, that the circumstances giving rise to Ataturk's decision came only as a result of the separation of the Arabs from the Turks, for which Britain is seen as holding prime responsibility. And it's worth pointing out that for some Muslims, the loss of the caliphate is seen as caused by the advances of Western imperialism, in the Muslim world, and consequently the general idea, I must emphasise that, of restoration is popular in certain quarters, but it doesn't necessarily resolve into support for just anyone who comes along and declares themselves caliph, and of course I'm referring to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. That's the relevance today. Iraq, let's turn to Iraq briefly. Having installed the Sharif of Mecca's third son, Faisal, as king of Syria in March 1920, Syria is then handed over to the French, and they kick him out in July. And in order to kind of restore some kind of honour, the British decide to make him king of Iraq, where in fact very few people had even heard of him. They were, in fact, the contenders for the leadership of the country. It's very interesting to see what happened to one of them. There was a prominent Baghdadi by the name of Sayyid Talib who went around the country advocating Iraq for the Iraqis, and he had gathered a lot of support. And it was reported with alarm to the British authorities that he'd received a magnificent reception everywhere. Now, what happened was he was invited to tea. I don't know what they're having, tea and muffins or something, at the residence of the High Commissioner, who was Sir Percy Cox, no relation. no relation, I wouldn't admit it if he was, but no relation, although he does have the family nose, I'd say. But this guy stayed away, it's absolutely true, stayed away while his wife entertained these guests. Meanwhile, Sir Percy orders the army, the British army, to go and arrest him, and they deport him to Ceylon. Another bit of British, I'm serious, that's what happened, another bit of British fair play there. And Cox's reasons were that he might incite violence. We'll look at violence in Iraq in a minute. In Iraq, the British created a state in which the majority of the inhabitants were Arab Shi, but with a government dominated by Sunni Arabs. Only 16% of the government posts were allocated to Shi'is. And this establishes the idea that Iraq is somehow naturally run by Sunni Arabs, and we know that's caused problems down to the present day. In addition, regarding the Kurds having promised the Kurds independence, the British did nothing to advance this, and the Kurds lost out essentially because, unfortunately for them, they lived in the area where it seemed like oil would be discovered. It was actually discovered in 1927. I'm nearly there. A combined Sunni, Shi and Kurdish rebellion began no sooner than the mandate for Iraq was announced. And I think it's quite well known now that in May 1919, Churchill advocated the use of poison gas against Iraqis, including civilians. He was quite clear on that. To be fair to him, and being fair to Churchill is something I find quite difficult, but whereas he was talking about lacrimatory gas, that's tear gas, Lawrence, on the other hand, was far less circumspect. In an article in The Observer in August 1920, he wrote, "It's odd that we do not use poison gas on these occasions. By gas attacks, the whole population of offending districts could be wiped out neatly." So he was talking about poison gas, quite definitely. And this is after the First World War, and where everybody knew the consequences. A bit on Palestine, then I'll wrap up. In Palestine, the consequences of British imperial policy, I think are best known of all, the implementation of the Balfour Declaration would necessarily lead to conflict, and this is not the wisdom of hindsight. Before the mandates were officially allotted by the League of Nations in 1920, there was an American Commission of Inquiry, and it established that the people of Palestine wanted to be part of Greater Syria, ruled by an Arab government in Damascus. They also established that the Zionists looked forward to a practically complete dispossession of the present non-Jewish inhabitants of Palestine, and that Palestinians were emphatically against Zionist colonization. Excuse me, I'm drawing. They also reported that no British officer consulted by the commissioners believed that the Zionist program could be carried out except by force of arms. And the covenant of the League of Nations, it seems quite fair in certain areas. The wishes of these communities, they're talking about of former Ottoman Empire, must be a principal consideration in the selection of the mandatory, and the well-being and development of such peoples forms a sacred trust of civilization. This is very solemn language. Balthus' private response to all this is interesting. He said, the contradiction between the letter of the covenant, which I've just quoted from, and the policy of the Allies is even more flagrant in the case of the independent nation of Palestine than in that of the independent nation of Syria. For in Palestine, we do not propose even to go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country. The four great powers are committed to Zionism, and Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad, is rooted in age-long traditions, in present needs and in future hopes of far profounder import than the desires and prejudices, the prejudices, by the way, of the 700,000 Arabs who inhabit that ancient land. And he went on to say, in short, so far as Palestine is concerned, the powers have made no statement of fact which is not admittedly wrong, and no declaration of policy which, at least in the letter, they have not always intended to violate. Now, that's often quoted. What is generally missed out, however, is that Balfour, after he ceased to be British Foreign Secretary, became the President of the Council of the League of Nations. So there he is, saying this is a load of rubbish, this covenant and so on, this solemnly declared, this sacred trust of civilization, and there he is saying it's a load of rubbish. I think Zionism, Balfour had also agreed with Chaim Weizmann that the democratic principle in Palestine reckons with the relative numerical strength and the brutal numbers operate against us, for there are five Arabs to one Jew. So again, not a war for democracy. Zionism, I think, was inconsistent with democracy in Palestine then as it is now. To conclude, the conduct of this war is an indictment of British imperialism and of imperialism in general. There is no benign form of imperialism. Imperial intervention, then as now, is necessarily divisive. There's no getting around this. And always the source of further conflict. The present crises in the Middle East have their roots in the British and French intervention in the First World War, and British imperialism is not superior to any other kind. There's a sort of soft jingoism where people think somehow we're better at it than anybody else. The First World War in the Middle East illustrates, I hope, very well that this is not the great war for civilization, nor was it a war for democracy, nor the rights of small nations, and rather undermines the idea that, as far as the British ruling class are concerned, fair play is a deep-rooted British value. I'll finish there. Thank you.